usage. Yeah, it's working.
Let's hope it works.
So, I told myself, might I video some of this?
What do you use the video for?
What am I going to use the video for?
Yeah.
I thought I'd put up an excerpt of it on the side.
It just, it's the audio? Heisenberg principle, I just completely don't like it.
So you want to just, can I take a couple still shots?
Sure. You want to shoot into the light. That's good. Yeah, you shoot.
How about if we let some of the light come in from the side? Do you mind if I do that? If you sat on the... Yeah. Sorry. All right, this is good. This is good. Okay. One, two, three. All right, one more time. One, two... Okay. My first thought...
Make sure you're happy, because I might have been... I think I
put
a blank.
Absolutely, sure.
I mean, really for your benefit, because...
Sorry, my fault. Yeah.
Take one more. It's so serious. I have
you
one of those...
Smile?
Yeah, I have one of those faces, you know?
Okay, there we go. One, two, three... That was good.
Good. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, like, Are you pissed off? Are you like, no? I'm just listening. I think I have one of those faces.
Okay. Have you read by any chance, given your relationship with Mr. Beatty, his Howard Hughes script?
No.
I just thought you were in the circle.
That circle is about the size of his own body. I think. No, very few people have read that.
You know, I've been. Not interviewing him and talking to him for a good 20 years.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, well, where's the harm? So I called him and I said, what I'd like to do, this is just me. I'm not talking about writing about it. I'm not talking about riffing on it. I'm not talking about no bragging rights. I just want to read the script.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I will know a little bit more. Someday I can maybe use that to my advantage. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, won't be impolite or, you know, say the wrong thing. Do you think I'm out of my fucking mind?
Yeah.
So, well, think of it. I've never burned you. I've never done the wrong thing.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
I would have been shocked if he had any other answer.
Yeah. So I was saying to myself last night that this is a little bit of an off point, but it seems to me that this is one of the most really sublimely scored films. Mm. Michael D.Y.
Dana.
Dana.
Yeah.
But something's unusual about the
spelling. Yeah, M-Y-C-H-A-E-L.
M-Y-C-H, yeah. And it's like that music understands everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes some music, you know, can like the Capote music was also very similar. But this is really good.
Mm.
And it just... and I was thinking, now, why did you choose him? Because I looked at his credits, and the only thing that I thought was noteworthy that he did before this, and he's done some kind of softer, slightly more sentimental films. There's one that I can't remember the name of it. There's one film in his credit that I thought, oh, that was good. Mm-hmm. So what brought you to him? He's Canadian?
Well, you know, he did Capote as well.
I completely didn't see that in his credits, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what brought me to him, to Capote, was The Ice Storm.
Okay.
Which was a movie that was set in a very particular period in a very particular place, and one that I happen to know because I grew up there and then as that story is depicted. And Michael's score expressed something entirely independent of that period and of that place.
Mm-hmm.
It's the early mid-70s.
Right. You didn't grow up in New Canaan.
I grew up in Mamaroneck. You could ride your... It's the same deal. It's the New Haven line. I could ride my bike there.
Okay.
You know, it's...
You know, I'm Wilford.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. But that... Yeah... the key parties, everything, just growing up around that crazy.
Right.
Off the record. Gotta protect the parents. That score, there's so much going on musically. It's just such a specific time, and to do something without those associations, to get underneath and find the undercurrents, and the instrumentation of it, it felt, you know, timeless, universal, other, and that's something that tracks with everything.
We all know what cue music is. It kind of tells you subtly that something's they should be listening to. You know, I just feel the facility with which the score works. I'm just knocked down. And it's almost not even the kind of score that you can listen to independent of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a soundtrack of any kind?
Yeah, it's coming out.
Coming out?
Actually, it might already be out. You might be able to order it.
Then I want to listen to it on its own.
You'd be surprised what good driving music it is. It's you really can listen to it. It's still in my head and in my veins. It's still coursing through it. I really love it. I urge you to speak to Michael. I think he will tell you this is the hardest job of his entire life. And
did you work extra hard on it or something?
This was one of the most difficult things to get right in the music, in the movie. But please call him, talk to him about it.
Definitely.
He'll be happy to talk to you. I'm going to do a Billboard event with a Variety Billboard event with him in a few weeks in L.A.
Okay.
Also.
Okay.
I know he's really proud of it. I'm in love with it.
Yeah.
It was hard to get to.
What's the epitome in my mind of the overbearing, please tone it down, baseball music? That would be like the natural score to me, you know.
Uh-huh.
That blares.
Yeah.
It's profundity or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And this never goes there. It's really just...
No.
Did you tell him frequently, look, it's, you're going to have to try again? Was it one of those relationships?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was. Capote was hard too, you know, and... I could have shied away after that experience because it was hard on both of us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're right. It's not expressive. It's not literal. It's not representative in the way that cue music often is. But what it attempts to do is conjure a kind of consciousness, you know, that allows us to observe the story instead of telling it.
Mm-hmm.
And the style of this movie is observational, you know, which I think requires that you conjure up a kind of consciousness. And ideally, you would... My favorite movies are the films where you feel like you're almost inside the brain of the filmmaker. You know, Kubrick, certainly. Every frame feels conscious. Hitchcock, there's no fingerprints on it, but you've got someone else's brain in your head.
Yeah.
You know, it's not telling you, it's not an external frequency that the music is communicating on. It's meant to like release your own chemicals to create the experience.
That's a good way of putting
it. You know,
I love the arc of Brad Pitt's relationship to Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it's the way it's very, very guarded. It's not a terribly good, great relationship, and it gets worse. It gets worse.
Yeah.
I love the scene when he comes into the office and ask him if he has a minute. Can you talk? And he almost says, "Let's not even talk." Just, but he actually says, "Okay, fine."
Yeah.
It's really an awful relationship, and it's so great. Everything that he does is that is so perfect.
Yeah.
But you would think. I don't know that it's necessary. I'm not saying it is necessary. But you would think maybe after particularly that moment where they walk by each other and don't. really acknowledge each other in the hall. But there might be one post-streak moment, something. Mm-hmm. But I guess that wouldn't be as interesting, because what's he going to do, right? I just love the... He's a great... I love him in this film.
Phil, yeah. Yeah. You know... He has his moment. It's not between the two of them, but the whole movie he's saying Hatterberg's not a first baseman, and he wants to bench him. And mm-hmm. there's all of these fights, and Billy Beane resorts to drastic action to force Arthaus' hand and make him play Hatterberg. And in game 20, he's benched, which in truth was because Billy himself, the day before, hesitated. Mm-hmm. And he contacted Art Howe and said, I want you to bench Hattie. John Mabry's hot. Let's bench him. Mm-hmm. And after a whole movie of Art Howe keeping... Mm-hmm. him on the bench at the bottom of the ninth in this historic game, he turns to him and just something no yeah. computer would ever do. Right. Like, he turns to the guy who Billy Beane hired because he sees a lot of pitches and draws a lot of walks. He sends him in there almost as a throw up your hands, sacrifice gesture to the baseball gods. And, mm-hmm. And, you know, in his reaction, you know, his satisfaction and celebration that you see is really right. all we allow of, you know, Art Howe's conclusion.
As I was saying to you in a text or an email, that the one of the riches of the film for me is that, as while it is a spreadsheet sabermetrics movie, it is the things that really lift you and get you are the moments that are not. Logical, that are kind of have a spiritual, mm-hmm. kind of a heavenly celestial mm-hmm. forces mm-hmm. having their way on some level. That's what I absolutely mm-hmm. in love with that. And was that something that you, talked out with Sorkin, that there's got to be, can't just be a stats movie, it's got to be something yeah. else. What was the essence of your conversation with them?
That
if you went in that direction, which I assume you did.
That nobody wants to see a baseball movie
anymore.
You know, certainly outside this country it's challenging, and inside this country historically they don't do as well as people might imagine. I didn't want to do simply a baseball movie, but baseball is an interesting medium to tell another story, you know. And there were a few clues in Michael Lewis's book that really interested me. One was when he says that Billy was somebody who came to believe that there was a life he was supposed to be living that he wasn't. That he made a decision when he was a kid to go down a road that led to a place he was not meant to be. There's a big check on the table and a temptation to do something that most wouldn't hesitate to take. And he went that way and found himself, you know, in a life that he would not have chosen. And I think I think every person in the world has got to acknowledge at some point that their life did not turn out the way they imagined it would have. Everybody, you know. And here's a character who is in that moment and learns from it. And there is a very traditional classic myth, you know, the wisdom myth that his life fell into here. And that myth is like the Wizard of Oz or King Arthur, that you've got somebody who is displaced, who's dislocated from the life that they're meant to have. And they find themselves a little bit lost and presented with some kind of impossible challenge, with the understanding that if you do this impossible thing, if you get the witch's broomstick or you get the Holy Grail, that order will be restored and you will be returned to where you're supposed to. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's, you know, that's what's underneath the whole thing. I mean, there are obviously many other interesting themes, and man versus the system, and...
Does the line about being told come from the Lewis book? Some of us are told when we're 18, some when we're 40, but we're all told.
Yeah. No, the fella who plays that scout, you know, who scouts Billy Bean, was an actual scout. And that scene was entirely improvised, and he just said that. He just said it. It came out of nowhere, and he said it once. And that was it. A lot of gems that just kind of cropped up.
Yeah. So, 6 years since Capote, right?
Right.
So your next film is in 2018? 2019. You're one of those guys like Kubrick, right? You think 6-7 years.
Right, right. That's right. It'll come out in 2019. Who knows what the technology will be? It's going to be projected on the moon.
Is that? I'm implying in a kind of a jocular way that you. I think that you're one of those guys who's very, very careful and doesn't. This is very carefully made. It's beautifully made. But I don't think that you're. It's in you to just bang something out. I just don't think it's in you. I know that you're a commercial director. And
yeah.
I obviously have to deliver on a certain thing, but I just don't have that feeling that you're that you're fast in a good way.
Yeah.
You know. Have you been fast in anything when you had to? I mean, I don't think any good work comes easily.
Yeah, you know what happens is whatever you engage yourself with, you end up caring, you know, and you want to work it to within an inch of your life, and it really is a horrible feeling to settle for something that you believe. Has an unrealized potential.
I'm not familiar, by the way, with the guy who plays the head scout who says "fuck you, Billy." He's great.
Yeah.
He's a real scout or an actor?
He's a real baseball guy.
I figured. Okay. He is great.
He is fantastic. He's a real baseball guy.
Great voice.
And fantastic voice. Great face. Real presence. And his story is that in a time when I was considering and being considered for Moneyball, I was shooting a commercial that had baseball in it. It was like a baseball themed commercial, and I like to use a lot of real people, and he came into the audition and he shows up and he's talking about his 30 years or so in baseball.
Who had he been with primarily?
He bounced around. He'd bounced around a lot. If you like, get his contact information.
I would love to talk to him. He's great.
Yeah,
he's
Kenny.
The real deal. Yeah, authenticity is quite unstable.
Ken Medlock is his name.
Right.
And so he's up there talking about his experience, and I said, let me ask you a question. What do you think of Billy Bean ruining the game that fast? Uh-huh. Ruining the game of baseball. Mm-hmm. Why? 5-minute monologue.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's stuck in your mind.
Yeah, I made a note.
All right.
And I thought, you know what, I'd love to talk to him again someday, you know, now that we're doing this thing, just to hear some of that, his thinking, and feel some of that vitriol. And I came in and interviewed him, and, you know, we're reading actors, and I said, why don't you read for this? And he'd done some acting, and ended up using him.
Now, there's one guy that I recognize from The Fighter, who is one of the scouts.
Yeah.
Irish
Yeah, guy. Rocco.
Right. But the rest of them, or most of the rest of them?
There were three actors in there. There are three.
Was Fabio an actor?
No.
No.
That guy's name is Phil Pote, and his nickname is the Ancient Mariner. He's been a scout for more than 50 years, and he's with the Seattle Mariners. The Ancient Mariner.
The way I describe Arliss Howard's scene, which is just perfect, is that it's kind of a little bit like the end of the old Perry Mason show. And William Hopper would sit down with Barbara Hale and Raymond Burr, and Hopper would go, so, now Perry, what actually happened was, and, you know, and then they sifted through for those who didn't quite, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not repetitive. It's it's very complete.
Yeah.
But that's more or less what the function is. He's stating what we've seen, but we get it.
That's part of it.
Yeah.
That's part of it. And another part of it is to mirror the experience he had when he was a kid, when they tell him, you're a five-tool player. You're an extraordinary. You know, you can run. You can hit. You can hit for power. You can field. You can throw. You know, you've got it all. This is going to be great. You know, and then there's a big check on the table. You know, it's.
I think this amount represents our sincerity and our belief.
Yeah, and so here he finds himself again at a crossroads, and this time he hesitates. And he thinks about it, and this whole business of evaluating players ends up being a wax on, wax off type exercise, I think, that puts you in the habit of looking twice at things, and you know, coming up with an eccentric conclusion, i.e., turning down this huge offer to run a big market team, historic team with a real shot at a championship.
Just after Julie Taymor came on stage on the opening night of Spider-Man, and you would think, well, she had been basically thrown under the bus by Bono. She had been, you know, she lost the thing. And I was thinking, well, listen, that these things happen, but you don't ignore or refuse to acknowledge the show. You put your heart into it, and it went as far as, you know. So she was being an adult. So in that spirit, I asked Soderbergh at this party last June, have you going to see Moneyball sometime soon? A movie I got fired off?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? What? You know, just move past it, man. You know, I mean, it was hurt. Of course it hurts.
Yeah.
But, you know. And he says, oh, I'll see it in my own time. So they say to you, listen, we just can't have guys talking to the camera. We need something a little more in here. And but in a classy way, we think you're the... Is that how it works?
No.
That's what the short version is.
I think.
We gotta go.
No, I think we have a few minutes.
What? Five-ish?
What time is it now?
I get 5:02.
What's that? It's
5:02 p.m.
It's 5:02 p.m.
Okay, we've got to wrap it up.
No, I definitely have a few minutes. I'm just thinking we're gonna go downtown, but we're gonna head there from downtown, right? I think we probably have 10 minutes, right? If Jeff wants it. Okay, yeah. If you want it, I mean. No, it's not how it worked at all.
Just the shorthand is, you know, that they felt they couldn't live with guys talking to the camera.
But it didn't work like that at all. It was more like I got a phone call from my agent, from Brian Lord, who said, are you interested in baseball? And I said, not really, since I was a kid, not that much. I mean, yes and no, but because you want to take a look at this thing. I said, sure. He goes, you know, if you're interested, Brad would like to talk to you. And so I read everything that there was to read and thought about it.
Versions,
the book, you know, did a little research of my own, thought about it, and came up with an approach that, you know, I thought would be worth the labor, mm-hmm. you know, of a few years to do if everyone agreed. And so it really wasn't like we'd like to do this or that or don't do this or do this. And I met with Brad. I said, this is how I see it. How do you see it? And there was, we were really compatible, you know. And, you know, I asked him questions, why he wanted to play this thing, what he saw in it. I told him, you know, I see doing it in such a way. And if not, no harm, no foul. And then, you know, met with everybody else, producer, studio, everybody, and said, look, this is the version I would love to do. If we're all making the same movie, that's fantastic. If not, it's going to be a very painful disappointment to everybody, because it's, no one's going to be happy ever, you know. And I said, if we feel good about this, great.
Briefly, reacquaint me. I know that the sequence was Zalian gets rewritten by Sorkin when you come in, mm-hmm. Scott Rudin's suggestion, I mm-hmm. presume, mm-hmm. and then Zalian comes back for his own polish. Is that how it works?
Back and forth and back and forth, okay. Actually, yeah.
Like a couple times each, you're saying?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. And,
is there a choice Sorkin line or two that I could, you could say that's his, and the choice Zalian too, or they just started to blend all together? And
no, they're actually pretty different and really complemented each other, you know. Yeah. They really served, I think, distinct roles. Yeah. And you know, Zalian came on and did much more of the structural, you know, organizing, and wrote a very soulful, hearty, and kind of dark, mm-hmm. you know, baseball movie. And and Sorkin has a genius for haiku, and he could sprinkle some magic dust and communicate something in a turn of a phrase and make you laugh and, like, stab you with meaning, you know. And I think the movie works that way, too. You know, the movie could have undercurrents and some depth and some seriousness, and then the next moment you're, you know, you're unexpectedly laughing, and then it hits you again with something else. So
why did you choose Spike? Everybody loves that. Why is he there? As a husband, he just happened to be talking to him or something.
I'm thinking who should Billy's ex-wife be married to? And you know, there is this there was a, you know, there is a direction in the movie that has Billy never being at home or comfortable in his own skin, or even when he's at home, this doesn't quite feel right. And the one scene where you see the ex-wife, you see that she has settled down with somebody and found some peace and has a real home and a partnership and everything else, and who should that be with? And I thought, well, it should be a real contradiction to Billy's character, which is to say somebody who's a little bit hippy-dippy, comfortable in his own skin, a little bit touchy-feely.
Yeah.
You know, he wears mandals.
Mandals. And that said a lot.
And you know, who's overly sincere, and that's Spike.
Whose line is, I hate losing so much, I hate it more than I love winning, and there's a difference. Is that a Lewis, a Sorkin, or a Zalian? Love that line.
I don't want to get myself in trouble. It's probably Sorkin, but it could be Zalian. You know, somebody said about, I think, you know, George Martin was interviewed once about Lennon and McCartney, and, you know, Lennon has a reputation for being the more profound one and McCartney for being the more musical one. Mm-hmm. Because the truth is that McCartney could, you know, you'd be wrong if you play that game. You know, that McCartney wrote some fantastic dimensional lyrics, and Lennon had some incredible, you know, was incredibly musical also. So it feels to me like a Sorkin line, but it that's one of the lines that I actually can't remember.
If I contact you, can you give me a phone number for Michael?
I can give it to you right this second.
Have you, for lack of a better term, this is played only to, okay?
Yes, 393-5717.
Right.
And that's all I've got on him, and that's all you'll need. For some reason, I don't have his email in here. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we had test screenings, you know, and we also had... you know, which are, you know, mall screenings and stuff.
Right.
And got those reactions. And based on my feeling about it and those screenings and whatever other, you know, studios, people, anyone brings, friends or whatever, those reactions, it became part of the plan to release the movie, to show it to as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. And I've been advocating since before the movie was done. I said, we should just screen it, just give it away. Mm-hmm. Give it away for a month, you know. And so they've been screening it in cities across the country, just anybody who wants to, just like, I don't know, they announce it somewhere, just free screening.
Right.
And then we get the reactions from that. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. been positive.
Well, I've seen it three times now.
Wow.
It's, it 2 hours and how many minutes?
Six or seven, I think, with credits.
Just not a moment too short. It's just right. Was there a longer cut? Is there going to be a Tammy Blanchard cut when it comes out on DVD?
There's not a longer cut, but there will be some omitted scenes, including a couple of Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes.
You mean after the streak?
Well, after they be during the streak.
Okay. Because the last thing we see of him is that look of, like, despite everything I've felt, said, and wanted, things are happening, and that look on his face, like, you know, that one little...
Yeah. There's a great scene that takes place during the streak.
Okay.
You know, once the team begins to turn around.
And it didn't advance the narrative, so it had to go.
Yeah. Well, it was married to other things as well, and those will also be in the extras.
Yeah. Good cutting. I didn't mention the editor, but that's sublime also, so... That, I imagine. How many different versions did you... I mean, how long did it take you altogether post... was it longer than what would be... What is a normal post?
Five or six months? I don't know what a normal post is, but we were cutting film probably for 8 months or something. It was a long time. I mean, certainly by a studio standard, we wrapped the film, and they called a post-production meeting before I even stepped into the edit. Mm-hmm. And they put a schedule on the table.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I looked at it, and I just said, it's totally unrealistic, and didn't take, you know, like, well, this is a schedule. I was like, well, the studio's going to have a choice, you know, mm-hmm. to release something half-baked or to stick with it.
And was the ending with the music, listening to the daughter's song on the radio, was that something you just decided upon in post, or was it written down, or... Because that was really nice.
Thank you.
End on a thematic note. It wasn't specific to baseball. It's just perfect.
When Karis Dorsey, the girl who plays Casey Bean, came to audition, we wanted the daughter to be able to play a little guitar and sing, and so we asked people to bring guitar. Just sing. We want to sing something, anything. She played that song, which is so strangely beautiful and perfect and poignant in a weird way. And I decided soon after that, certainly it was, you know, put it in the script that the movie would end with that.
My son, who knows music 15 times better than me, pointed out immediately that you're of course, I can understand why you thought it might be a variation of the Juno song. That was my first.
Ah.
It sounds like it. Yeah, it does sound like it. You at least acknowledge that.
No, right? Well, the moment you said that, I'm like, oh my God, is that the Juno song? But it hadn't occurred to me until you said it.
Just you probably listen to them, you see certain similarities. Mm. All right, not a big point. Well, maybe we can do it again.
You know how to reach me, man.
Yeah.
You know how to reach me. Jeffrey, thank you.
Thanks for your time. All right.